Donc c'est vraiment une grande joie pour nous de recevoir Randall Collins. On serait aux États-Unis ou dans le monde anglo-saxon, je vous dirais, on ne présente pas Randall Collins. C'est certainement un des sociologues, sinon le sociologue le plus connu aux États-Unis aujourd'hui. Un des deux ou trois, en tout cas, à coup sûr. Une œuvre considérable et de la plus haute importance, en sociologue d'abord, grand spécialiste de Max Weber. Je l'ai connu pour ses travaux sur la violence et ses théories, ses approches de la violence. Il est... I don't remember where you are professor now.
I've retired from the University of Pennsylvania.
Retraité, dit-il, de l'Université de Pennsylvanie. Et il écrit aussi des fictions, dont certaines ont quelque chose à voir avec les thèmes dont il va nous parler. Donc, je vais lui donner la parole. Il parle en anglais. Est-ce qu'il y en a parmi vous qui ont des difficultés avec l'anglais? Ok. Merveilleux. So everybody will understand you. Yes. You can talk in English. So we have all together 2 hours. So you split them half. For instance, you present your paper and then we talk, or you think they can take less or more as you like.
Yes, all right, very good.
Okay. Voilà. Okay. So merci beaucoup. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes,
it's an honor and a pleasure. The French people are very parochial, so they don't know so much about foreign sociology. I've heard something about Marx and Max Weber, but after that, it's more difficult for us. But we are all very proud to have us to have you with us.
Yes, well, when you're at the center of the intellectual world of the last 150 years, you have whatever liberties you need to take. But I thank Michel Vivioca for the invitation to this seminar and to his équipe who've arranged everything. My title, Symbiosis of Terrorist Tactics and High Tech with Some Unthinkable Countermeasures. I was just reading the questions that Michel had proposed, and maybe they're not quite so unthinkable, but maybe there's a little bit more unthinkable since I was recently at a conference in England with quite high-ranking military officers who directed the war in, that is, U.S. and U.K. officers who directed the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so some of what I'm going to say comes from them without attribution to anyone. That was their condition, no names. During the series of wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Syria, insurgents have used low-tech weapons against Western forces and their allies. Typical are suicide bombers who carry explosives right up to their target, and IEDs, improvised explosive devices. Perhaps the acronym is different in France, IED.
I am not an expert in this technical field. So
improvised explosive devices hidden in the roadway and set off by a mobile phone.
Est-ce que quelqu'un connaît le mot technique français pour ces techniques d'explosion à distance?
I guess we just took the IED.
IED, okay, okay. Yeah, all right. So set off by mobile phone when an enemy vehicle passes. But these have acquired a high-tech component. The spotters who see a vehicle approach do not have to communicate directly with the trigger man who sets off the bomb. Both are connected, perhaps, to a coordinator in an internet cafe in Brussels. We can trace the link, but we can't do anything about it. Ironically, this parallels the command structure of U.S. high-tech military, where spotters, those who find the enemy targets, can be special forces putting laser tags on the enemy, or silent drones flying overhead, or satellites in space, all sending information to a remote headquarters, like the Air Force base in Florida that controlled the 2003 invasion of Iraq. How did this situation come about, and what direction is it heading in the future? The pattern of military high tech has been building up since the First World War, the 1914-18 World War. weapons have gotten more lethal and more accurate and increasingly longer distance. I mean, this was first noticed in the suicidal attacks against machine guns during 1915, 1916. But that trend has continued. The digital revolution in the last 30 years has vastly increased targeting information by aerial surveillance and satellites using an array of sensors that track vehicle movements and even individual humans by infrared heat signature, by radar, by computer-enhanced photographic imagery, which can be compared over time to look for telltale changes. Enemy headquarters can be located by its buzz of electronic activity. Enemy rockets or artillery that use radar for their targeting can be tracked by radar-seeking devices, similar to auto drivers locating a police radar track and fire back immediately to destroy the enemy weapon. I mean, underline the point here. They use radar to seek their target. We have a radar-seeking device, and we see it's coming from that weapon, and almost instantaneously, they send out the radar, and we send a rocket to hit where that radar is coming from. It's coming from their weapon. Huge supercomputers assemble the information into a composite picture of the battlefield, and remote computers increasingly control firing on enemy targets, whether from aircraft, ships, or ground-based weapons. So it's not just that the information is coming into the computers. In many respects, the computers are actually firing the weapons. This began with fire control planes, which fly maybe 100 kilometers away from the aerial battlefield, and they actually control the firing from the fighter attack planes. You ask why there is a pilot. There's a pilot on the plane, not to fire the weapons, but in case something goes wrong. What follows from this? Troops and their equipment cannot be bunched together, since this makes them too vulnerable a target. Instead, they are dispersed across the territory. In World War II, that is up to 1945, the front was typically 5 kilometers from one brigade to another. Now it's 150 kilometers. Forward operating bases, supplied by helicopter and communicating electronically, make a checkerboard of mostly empty battle space. Does this game have the same name in French? A checkerboard? Like a chessboard. But with mostly empty spaces.
Un jeu d'échecs, mais un certain nombre de cases qui sont vides, c'est bien ça.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's a mostly empty battlefield with bases at great distance from each other. If the enemy has similar weapons, that is what we call symmetrical war, if both sides have the high-tech weapons, even the most high-tech troops must take advantage of natural cover and hide their electronic and heat signatures as much as possible. I mean, so that before the big battles began in 2003, you had to turn off all the engines in your armored vehicles because the heat from your engine would be targeting information for the enemy rockets. World War II was the last such war between what the military calls peer adversaries that both sides have approximately the same weapons. So 1945 was the last such war, at least among Western powers. There was a big tank battle in Pakistan, I think, in the early 70s, when thousands of tanks, they were probably all American tanks, both Pakistan and India, fired at each other. There's a huge tank graveyard in the Ram of Kutch on the Pakistan-Indian border. So this is what you call peer adversaries. They both have the same weapons. In the West, most wars since that time have become asymmetrical, although The U.S. military is now planning for a symmetrical high-tech war with China. Most wars in the last 50 years have been asymmetrical between a high-tech military versus a low-tech insurgency. U.S. forces have had the luxury of not having to hide on the battlefield and could take their time in planning set-piece campaigns to root out insurgents. The resource-poor side of an asymmetrical war has responded by dispersing its forces even more. So but my argument is that this trend already started 103 years ago, approximately, 1915, when it became recognized that you could not march your forces in mass into battle. You would have to disperse them. In fact, it's said that in 1916, approximately, the Germans invented the Stoßtruppen, who did not march into battle. They hid in the trenches and through the grounds, so that you had to disperse their forces. That dispersion has continued even more. And now I want to argue that the weaker side, the side that lacks the high-tech weapons, must disperse even more than the high-tech side. But it's the same process. The resource-poor side disperses their forces and makes hit-and-run attacks on isolated enemy bases and the supply lines between them. I mentioned a few minutes ago the checkerboard where they're operating bases supplied by helicopters, which it could have quite some distance between them. The supply by helicopter is expensive. It's preferable to supply by ground vehicles if possible. And this is exactly what guerrillas attempt to attack. This is called guerrilla war. As long as it attacked military targets, it became terrorism when it concentrated on civilian targets, since these are softer and less protected than military targets. Guerrilla war slides over into terrorism because guerrillas, between their attacks, hide in the civilian population. Terrorists generally are civilians and they live among other civilians, especially in cities or towns, since these provide the most cover against high-tech weapons. You know, so it was that array of sensors that I was talking about, infrared sensors that seek out the heat from an enemy vehicle, even the amount of heat from individual human beings. The cities provide the most cover against high-tech weapons. Urban sight lines are poor. It is difficult to distinguish the heat signatures of civilians from combatants. High-tech surveillance is evaded by hiding in the electronic clutter of normal life. So even in the electronic world, you try and hide your military electronic signals among the normal signals. So it would be foolish for the guerrillas to fight out in the countryside, you know, where their electronics would stand out. In the city, cities provide the most cover against high-tech weapons. Because even in poor countries, mobile phones and other consumer electronics are the features of modernity that diffuse the fastest. The biggest problem in fighting urban guerrillas is political. They use other civilians as shields, and they welcome civilian casualties because these turn the local population against the outside enemy. We saw this actually at the beginning of the war in Syria, where initially the cities in northern Syria, especially Aleppo, were not at all favorable to the guerrillas. But the guerrillas hid there. They were attacked by the regime, and accordingly the population as the result of these, predictable atrocities, were able to recruit more support to them themselves. Atrocities are thus the major recruiting tool for militant terrorists and revenge-seeking suicide attackers. To sum up, terrorism grows in symbiosis with high-tech weapons and communications because the weaker side cannot win on conventional battlefields. Politically, moreover, an insurgency does not have to win battles. It does not need to take territory, but only to resist pacification by an outside enemy. I should add, the Islamic State, or Daesh, made the mistake in Iraq and Syria of taking territory, setting up a state structure, and using more conventional military tactics. This transformed Daesh into the weaker side of a somewhat more symmetrical war. Similarly, the Taliban in Afghanistan were an easy target in 2001 when they were a government, but hard to eradicate when they were guerrillas. Small numbers of insurgents can keep a war going. Their main resource is advertising their presence by spectacular attacks, even if they are committing bloody atrocities of their own. As long as their actions are well publicized, they just demonstrate a will to continue the fight. The insurgents expect to prevail over a period of time, if only because occupying forces lose the political will to persist. On the high-tech side, a modern military is surrounded by news networks as well as its own communications media, and such a modern military, typically the U.S., but indeed all the European militaries as well, a modern military cannot avoid having its own atrocities publicized worldwide. It doesn't matter if civilian casualties are accidents, or if the civilian casualties are the result of emotional reactions by occupying troops embittered by fighting an enemy who hides and disguises themselves as civilians. Let me elaborate on that just a little bit. So even in a high-tech war, the soldiers still have emotions, and one of the most important emotions is when you can't tell where your enemy is. You know, particularly, your enemy is among these civilians, and some of them are your enemies. And after a while, the troops tend to kind of go past a dividing line there, where since everybody looks like an enemy, and some of them are attacking us, some of the troops really lose their emotional control. So some of these well-publicized atrocities. I remember there was a sergeant in the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. This happened a couple of years ago, who went out at night and entered a local village and killed many civilians. This is a deliberate attack on killing civilians. This sergeant was the security officer at one of these isolated forward operating bases, and there have been a number of attacks from the surrounding Afghanistan army troops, the so-called green-on-blue attacks. You know this term means? So in the military, blue means us. We are the blue forces. If on the computer screens they have, we're always blue. The enemy is red. The green are supposed to be your allies. Green on blue means somebody who's your ally, who is right next to you, attacks you. And so this, I think you can see the psychology of it. This man was in charge of security. He was supposed to stop these attacks. And at night, he just sort of went crazy and went out into the village and started killing people. I'm not excusing it, but I think the psychology is understandable. Thus, the war becomes a war of opposing atrocities. Atrocities are the major recruiting tool for the militant terrorists and for suicide attackers who are seeking revenge. Saying that
modern Western militaries are surrounded by news networks, and so they cannot avoid having their own atrocities publicized worldwide. The cell phone photos of American soldiers humiliating and torturing prisoners at Abu Ghraib are typical of the ubiquitous Western media. The American soldiers have a lot of cell phones, and they're capable of taking pictures of them. And so just like everyone else, they took pictures and sent them to their friends. And of course, they got out into the media. This is typical of the ubiquitous Western media redounding to their own political disadvantage. It's not that what the high-tech soldiers are doing today is really very different than what you can see happen, certainly in the First World War and in previous wars, it's said in World War, this kind of expression on the British troops in the First World War, if an attack succeeds and they reach the enemy trenches, and then the German soldiers come out to surrender, the British would say, "Too late, chum." Bam. Today that would be an atrocity. In those days, there were no cell phones and no reporters out on the front line. The growth of worldwide high tech is shifting the crucial balance of military power, shifting the balance to communications. The irony here is that global communications, both for consumers and as a major component of the post-industrial economy, means that every innovation in a rich capitalist country, every time we invent a new app for our smartphone, it creates a military opportunity for insurgents. It is not so much that they imitate our weapons, although they can capture modern weapons, especially from the West's so-called local allies, but they can capture or indeed buy them from our allies, but everyone shares in the digital communications because these are marketed worldwide. So in a certain sense, the inventions of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and worldwide electronic capitalism are spreading exactly these devices that shape the conditions for guerrilla war and terrorism. Many of the most advanced surveillance systems are umbrellas covering everything within their range, friend and foe alike. Both sides are operating inside the same electronic umbrella. In Iraq, insurgent firing were coordinated via internet cafes in Belgium, just as, in the same way, U.S. soldiers could connect to internet cafes or indeed any other sites in the world for private communication with their family and friends. Mobile phones are used to trigger IEDs, the bombs hidden in the roadway, but shutting down the local cell phone network is not feasible, since the U.S. commanders themselves use mobile phones as a more reliable alternative to centralized military communications channels. GPS coordinates, global positioning system coordinates, which are pinpointed by a network of satellites around the Earth, are used both by allies targeting insurgents and by insurgents targeting us. The terrorist attacks on the hotels in Mumbai in India in 2008 was run by the ISI from Karachi, Pakistan. Again, using the worldwide GPS and mobile phone system. Terrorist fighters might be killed in action, but the main principle of modern military doctrine, which is to decapitate the enemy by knocking out enemy headquarters, knocking out their command and control, and thus destroying it as a functioning organization. This strategy has become impossible. It's becoming impossible against organized guerrillas or terrorists. There is no enemy command post. The insurgents have no command post in theater, as the military say. But ostensibly, their command post is on ostensibly neutral foreign soil. There need not be any clandestine network on the spot to uproot, as the French attempted to do during the Algerian War. I mean, that is, you know, this rather infamous counter-guerrilla war in Algeria, where there's an attempt to, you know, actually capture someone from the network and then get them to give the information. So there was no way to do that when the network itself is so dispersed so far from the battlefield. Mobile phones are used to trigger IEDs, but shutting down the local cell network. I'm sorry, I read that sentence again. Commands and targeting information are sent out by one-way messages on the open internet. Let me explain that a little bit further. Instead of having a conversation by phone or by email, it is broadcast. It's broadcast only. You know, so you don't know where it's going to. No one replies to it. The source may be traced, but the source is remote and, if possible, in a neutral country where it can't be attacked. In the Russian semi-proxy war in the eastern Ukraine, the Ukrainian military used the same satellites as the Russians. Indeed, they were the same country not very long before this war broke out. And so neither side could disrupt the other's targeting without disrupting their own. Cyber war has been growing as a cheap resource for insurgents, because insurgents operate inside the same global communications umbrella as their resource-rich enemies. The US, or anyone else in the West, does not have an advantage in cyberspace. Indeed, by concentrating on digital high-tech, the West is playing in an arena where its advantage in other kinds of military resources do not count. Cyber war can, of course, also be practiced by wealthy states, but it is above all a weapon of the weak. Its physical tools, the tools of cyber war, are easily available commercially. Skill at hacking requires no great organizational coordination and is easily acquired by alienated youth all over the world. Fighting a cyber war is exactly the wrong place for wealthy states to fight. So, what can be done or will be done about the great power's loss of military advantage in a cyber-linked world? Here we come to an unthinkable solution that the military is actually thinking about. I just read Michel Vigorka's questions a few minutes ago, so it's not so totally unthinkable, but this is it. The unthinkable solution that Western militaries, certainly the U.S. military, is now thinking about: shutting down the internet in time of war. This is a shorthand way. When I say internet, I refer to all the communications devices under the modern world umbrella that are shared with their adversaries: mobile phones, GPS coordinates, and network computers. But how can these be shut down without enormous damage to our own economy and our contemporary way of life? Air travel and also, increasingly, ground travel are coordinated by digital networks. So are power grids, hospitals, and police forces. So are most financial transactions, ranging from international banking to personal salaries and bill paying. So now are the huge business of online shopping and delivery. In fact, one of the most devastating forms of cyber war now being worried about is a cyber attack, not from isolated mischief-making hackers who just want to cause trouble, or from thieves who want to make money, but from an enemy government or insurgency aimed at shutting down the economy of one of the rich capitalist nations. More primitive economies would be safer from attack, being less reliant on digital coordination. This is an extremely dangerous prospect, but it is not the most dangerous event that could happen. Since a ultra-modern military is so heavily organized around electronic command and control, The worst threat to the existence of the military itself would be if an enemy could hack into its links to disable its weapons, its mobility, and its logistics. In effect, the electronic giant would become blind, deaf, and paralyzed. The military giant, whose nervous system is electronic, could be rendered completely paralyzed if an enemy could hack into its into its electronic network. And indeed, this is the scenario envisioned in P.W. Singer's novel, The Ghost Fleet, where Chinese-made components in American electronics are programmed to put the entire U.S. military out of operation during a surprise attack. I don't know if any of you know this novel, but at the very beginning of the novel, since the U.S. buys so many electronic components from China, some of them carry sleeper cells. And so at the beginning of the attack, the U.S. military becomes incapable of doing anything. In the novel, the Chinese are satisfied themselves with taking Hawaii. But there is one nightmare that goes beyond this scenario, not just that the enemy would disable our military so it would not operate. Enemy hackers could leave the operational system of the military intact, but take over the controls of our weapons so that our rockets and aircraft are turned around to fire against us, to fire on ourselves. And indeed, there have been some steps in this direction. As Iranians and others, Hezbollah has been mentioned, been able to capture some U.S.-made drones by diverting their remote controls. If the U.S. military's digital control system is seriously threatened by an enemy, the response now being considered is to shut down the entire digital umbrella. As I said, this is based on my discussions with high-ranking U.S. and U.K. military commanders. There are two ways this could happen. Either the enemy themselves shut down the digital network or attacks it to the extent that it becomes useful, or we shut it down preemptively to keep our enemies from using it. Probably there would be several levels of shutdown. The smallest would be to shut down all mobile phone and internet activity in a given area. For instance, shut down all the mobile phones in Iraq or Syria, by shutting down the cell phone towers and servers. Or the internet or mobile phones could be put on a one-way broadcast mode. I didn't realize this actually could be done, because we actually think it's quite decentralized. It's sort of decentralized, you know, at the level which we operated. But there are servers, and they could be put in a one-way direction so that messages can only go out from a central point of view. In fact, there was a emergency warning system in Hawaii about maybe 1 month ago that it's just at a time when there was a lot of tension about North Korean rockets, and the message erroneously went out that this is not a test, this is a nuclear attack. And people could not, since it changed all the system there in Hawaii to one-way broadcast, there was no way to check it out. It created quite a panic there for a number of hours before the authorities finally realized what message had been erroneously sent. And so that changing to a one-way broadcast mode would be something that could happen, and all other messages that are not coming from the central source are not allowed to operate on the internet. Another choice would be to shut down crucial targeting infrastructure, such as the satellites would circulate the Earth and send information about both electronically and visually what is happening down below, such as the GPS system. Since this is a satellite-based system and the satellites circulate around the Earth, it would affect the entire world. such plans are being seriously contemplated, as plans to shut down the GPS system in time of war. Reportedly, the Chinese are building their own GPS system with their own satellites that would be inaccessible to others. This seems unthinkable since GPS is included in all sorts of devices, including ordinary smartphones. But GPS was originally created as a secret project by the US military as a way of preventing aerial collisions and other blue-on-blue attacks. Remember, blue or us. We're the good guys, we're blue. And GPS was opened up to commercial use in the 1990s. In the same way, the internet originated as the DARPANET, Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration of the US military. I don't know if any of you remember this, but my first encounter, what people, you go to a conference and say, are you on DARPANET? You know, it was very prestigious if you could get on the DARPANET. The Clinton administration opened it up to the public. So there was precedent for returning GPS to government control. We could go back to the way GPS operated before 1990. And it may become a matter of military necessity or what is presented to the public as such. You should not expect that history has one continuous trajectory and that technologies and social customs surrounding them become impervious to removal once they become widespread. Just because we are used to, not everybody has access to GPS and to the internet, we're so habituated to it, we think we can't go back. It's technically feasible to go back. The Chinese government use of supercomputers with facial recognition systems for tracking the mood of every citizen shows what kinds of things are technically possible. I mean, it's actually Orwell's 1984. In 1948, they only had television, so the television watched you instead of you watching the television. But now it's like, genuinely, Orwell's system is being put into practice. Such things may be politically repugnant in some countries and not in others. In fact, Chinese citizens of the future might welcome some kind of emergency that caused a shutdown of its central government computers. But how would the military continue to operate under this unthinkable contingency, shutting down the electronic networks that have become the core of its own military organization? Planning on this point is proceeding, and I can't tell you too much about this, not because I'm being reticent, but because, I don't have enough secret clearances to be able to get into it, but you hear about it. The essential pattern is to build backup procedures, how to run a war without the internet, without computer links, without GPS or mobile phones. Indeed, there is a discussion inside the US military, and I think inside the UK military. I'm not too familiar with the French military, but I wouldn't be too surprised. The French military's reputation is very secretive. Discussion about how over-reliance on our digital networks even now is reducing military efficiency and weaning ourselves away from it. We tend to forget that the ultra-computerized military is a relatively recent thing. Big mainframe computers were developed in the military from World War II onwards. The dispersed, handheld, small-scale computers that now fill our world through commercial and private network. These devices became spread very rapidly in the late 1990s through the early 2000s. Military officers have commented on the huge increase in computerization inside the military that began since the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003. So a company that's about 200 soldiers at that time had five computers, and they were operated by the executive officer, that's the second in command, and the first sergeant, who is the first line manager. Now all officers have computers, so much so that they spend 75% of their time reporting to headquarters. A U.S. general commented, "Network has become more problem than solution." On Navy ships, the traditional system, now with the traditional system since about 1915, was a single wireless link that was under the authority of the ship's captain. All messages that went to and from the ship, or from the radio operator who reports directly to the ship's captain. Now all sailors are in possession of personal computers or smartphones. The official channels are surrounded by unofficial links used for personal reason. Hence, all news gets out, even if it is confidential. Officers have become risk averse, since even minor mishaps are scrutinized. Junior officers lose initiative and feel they must clear any decision of higher command. This is from a discussion with some Navy personnel who are complaining about the loss of effectiveness when all the sailors in the boat have their own smartphones. Similarly, with the profusion of information from battle sites gathered by electronic sensors and relayed to all levels of the command network, the term was developed, predator pawns. As if predator drones, yes, I'm sure you know predator, because the name of a particular kind of military drone, are pawns in a chess game. Higher officers, as well as drone operators, can watch the video feed from the drone. The result is a strong temptation to micromanage. It's as if the top general can be right there at the front line. He can actually see what the target is and then give orders about what to fire at. This is a general problem for all military organization. Wars have become increasingly political in the sense that counterinsurgency is largely a fight for hearts and minds, a favorite journalistic and military cliche. A major recruiting device for guerrillas and terrorists are their dramatic or even cruel and gruesome attacks, such as videos of vast beheadings, which are circulated on the social media. The same dialectic encompasses the Western forces through periodic scandals of civilian atrocities. And these atrocities become more or less inevitable, given that the presence of civilians is exactly where the insurgents make the battlefield. There's this wonderful painting by Goya. I forget what it's called. I think it's called La Guerre. And it shows this huge giant striding across the land, and everybody's fleeing. Well, okay, so that's traditional war, where the battlefields were empty, soon empty of everyone except the two opposing armies. Now, because of the asymmetry of the guerrillas can't possibly fight against the high-tech weapons, they disperse into the civilian population, and that's where they choose to fight. There are many channels for war stories to leak out. Politicians are under pressure to achieve results, but also highly vulnerable to criticism for mistakes. All this increases the tendency for politicians to intervene, even at the smallest tactical level. A U.S. commander that I talked to a few months ago said, he was in charge of an operation in Syria. He spent most of his time going back and forth with a high official in Washington about whether loads of small arms could be dropped to local Kurdish allies. Multinational forces are considered politically desirable, but U.S. advisors say that the resulting organizational chart is a wiring diagram. Get the picture here of all the little electronic connections, incredible complexity to it, and that's your organizational chart. U.S. commanders spend most of them are talking about the Iraq War, or here. One of the commanders that I talked to was actually in charge of the offensive that retook the territory around Monpozo. He said they spend most of your time clearing requests for resources with the National Security Council and Iraqi politician. When the military say request for resources, they mean to say essentially, can we use so many bombs, rockets, planes, helicopters? The solution to the cyber hacking is to shut down the computerized system and to build another control system that the enemy is not shared. High-tech aircraft have enormous capacities for locating enemy targets and firing back at their electronic location, But since both sides can do this, the result is to destroy a large proportion of the most advanced aircraft on both sides. They're going to need to explain this a little bit further. I actually decided to envision another U.S. Civil War because the question was, what would a high-tech army do fighting another equally high-tech army? Well, there's really only one extremely high-tech army in the world, and it is the U.S. Army. And I thought, well, actually, this happened before. And so that the same officers who've been trained, the same military academy, actually fought each other in 1861 to 1865 in exactly the same way, with exactly the same tactics. It turned out to be that the side that had the strongest economic base, the North, just simply was able to throw more soldiers into the battle until it actually won the war. But so that's, you know, essentially the thought experiment of, you know, what would happen if both sides have the same high-tech weapons. Now remember some of the ones that I described at the beginning, you know, such as targeting system, which looks for the enemy targeting system, for instance, if that's radar-based, we look for a radar source, you know, just like driving a car where you locate where the police have their radar, and then you fire back at it. Okay, now that's an interesting kind of thing because both sides can do the same thing. Now what happens if both sides have this extremely quick response to their high-tech weapons? Well, probably as the law of average, they both destroy each other a lot. And so after a period of time, and I do not think this is very long, aircraft are extremely expensive. I envision after probably a month of doing this, neither side would have an operative air force. And now as it exists now, now insurgents in asymmetrical war, they try and capture some surface-to-air missiles, you know, and occasionally they can shoot something down. But if both sides, you know, have the same spotting systems, the same aircraft, the same surface-to-air missiles, essentially it's just going to be a war of technical attrition. And in a fairly short period of time, most of the most advanced weapons are going to be destroyed. The most advanced aircraft are the most expensive and take the longest time to build, as well as requiring assiduous maintenance between missions. The B-2 stealth bomber, which is built to fly extremely long distances, to be impervious to enemy radar, requires being painted with a special chemical coating every time it flies. It costs several $1 million for every flight because of the refitting that has to go out. It costs $1 billion each in order to be built. There are only 20 of them because they're so expensive. You apply that generally throughout the high-tech world. In a certain sense, the Achilles heel of the high-tech world is it is extremely expensive. Attrition of such weapons would inevitably result in older weapons being pressed into service. Now, another thought experiment that I've attempted is to imagine what a war between robots would be like. These would not be the Hollywood humanoid giants that you see in Star Wars. It's foolish to try to make a robot that looks like a giant human and walk on 2 feet. They still don't even have a human-sized soldier who can walk on 2 feet. Their robots would be armored tanks containing no humans driving them. They would essentially be driverless cars firing at each other. There considered to be a lot of advantage to having driverless cars in the military, because if you have a tank with human beings in it, then you have to have some way for people to breathe. You need to have things that protect them against fire. You have to have ways for them to escape. If there are no humans in the tank, that tank is a lot simpler to make. So what would happen if both sides have the same kind of robot armor? My inference is the outcome of the battle would depend not on the superiority of one side's robots over the other, but the skill and energy of human beings going out on the battlefield to repair damaged robots. So in other words, it's kind of a logistical issue of these things get damaged. Many of them can be repaired, but humans are just much faster at being able to repair things. So humans actually come back into this, not as soldiers, but as repair personnel. My chief conclusion is that a war fought between two very advanced militaries would lead over time to mutual degradation and a return to earlier forms of warfare. I'm getting near the end. I've already suggested that remote computerized communications and control would be shut down early in such a war. That is, for the reasons I spoke about at the beginning, the military would actually not want to operate in an electronic umbrella that is shared by both sides. And in fact, it would be very dangerous for them to do it. If both sides have drones, army helicopters, anti-missile, and robot vehicles, mutual attrition would eventually result in humans making the difference. High-tech stalemate will drive combat back to the human level. The idea that has prevailed for about a century, and this has been sort of, you know, a common military and political doctrine for at least since 1915. The state will win who creates the next super weapon before the other side did. This is very much the mindset in the 1930s and 40s, and the Germans almost got there with their rockets. It was the reason why the atomic bomb was developed. We have to develop before the other side gets it. This idea that the state will win who creates the next super weapon before the other side does will probably not hold in the future. This is because the recent wave of digital technologies, whose initial thrust has come especially from military inventions, has spread into the civilian economy and ordinary life. Warfare centered in the cybersphere gives most advantage to the disruptors of the other side's communication. This is true whether it is asymmetrical terrorist attacks against military and economic giants or a symmetrical war between states with equally sophisticated equipment. Let me underline that point again. Why is it that getting the latest super weapon isn't the way to win the next war? Because the super weapons now are these dispersed cyber networks, and those are precisely the ones which actually favor the resource poor side. It's very difficult to acquire a B-2 stealth bomber. It's difficult to acquire an armored helicopter. You find the right people on the battlefield, Syria, you might be able to get hold of a Patriot anti-aircraft or anti-missile, but being able to try and shut down or subvert the entire enemy's communication system from an internet cafe is just too widely dispersed. Our idea that history is moving in a straight line is wrong. What seems unthinkable now, shutting down the internet and all the other digital media, in one degree or another, is likely to happen. Where we come out on the other side of that crisis will probably become normal to people who live in it. Just as the digital devices of the last 15 years have become so normal, we can't imagine living without them. We adapt so rapidly. As you have something for even just 5 years now, you think, how could you possibly live without it? If we continue to live, it is probably because we will have learned how to get along without them. Thank you for your attention.
My question is regarding to the title of your conference. You talk about the symbiosis between technological and the different actors. And my question is, what can you say about drug dealings and the drugs cartels in South America and the link with technology? You have an opinion of that? You link more like terrorists or something different? If you see something particularly of that
type of conflict that is happening mostly in Mexico, in the past, in Colombia. What can you say about that? That's my question.
Right. Drug cartels on the whole are not really very high tech. They attempt to operate underneath the radar, underneath the surface of wherever the high tech weapons happen to be.
I would like to know what you think about the link between technology and drugs cartels in South America, when it appears a conflict between the different governments and the drug cartels. What do you see between this link with technology in this conflict, in this particular type of conflict?
You mean
well? Please.
You mean in these conflicts where we pass from politics to criminality, drug traffic, but you have violent actors. This is your question.
That's my question.
Would you have the same kind of analysis when the actors are not political and much more criminal? That's the question.
My impression is that the drug cartels really operate in as low tech a way as possible. I mean, the more high tech you are, the easier it is to locate where they are and to counteract whatever technology they're operating. It's sort of like I'm gonna give you an analogy here from modern guerrilla warfare, the IED, an American military acronym, improvised explosive device. The simpler it is, the more difficult it is to counteract it. It's the simplest version of all is a suicide bomb. So it's carried by somebody. They can't be electronically hacked or dissuaded. They just carry it immediately up to their target and explode it. The high tech for ever since the Second World War has really been the advance of computerized communications and control, and so high-tech weapons of that sort are essentially attacked by electronic means. So if you can hack into somebody else's system, maybe you can disable it. The worst thing that can happen to you is if they hack into your system and turn it around against you. I mean, so how do they, what is the defense against this? One defense is to actually have a backup of more low-tech weapons. I mean, I've considered in the past what would happen in as a high-tech war went on, and eventually, if both sides are symmetrical, and indeed, this is the kind of argument I was making in a novel I wrote a few years ago called Civil War II. It's about what would happen if the U.S. military split into two and fought each other. Why did I choose this example? Because the U.S. is the preeminent high-tech military, and I wanted to have a case where one very high-tech army fights another very high-tech army. And indeed, we have in the United States itself, an example of exactly this. In 1861, the U.S. Army split, and indeed the same officers trained in the same way with the same weapons fought with each other. The weapons at that time were not really very sophisticated, and so it eventually just became a war in which the side with more a bigger economy and more population was simply able to wear the other side down by attrition. In the first U.S. Civil War, the better officers, for some reason, were on the side of the South. The North responded by finally getting a couple of generals, especially Grant and Sherman, who were just willing to use their advantage. We have a lot more soldiers, and we will just simply throw as many in there, take as many casualties as possible, you know, and overwhelm the South, who had quite good soldiers and officers, just not as many. So that could be the the same sort of thing that it operate on the very very high tech level. My conclusion from making that sort of analysis is that if a high tech war goes on for a long time, both sides would eventually destroy most of their high tech weapons, and the side which was able to back themselves up with low tech weapons would be the ones who would win the war. So that's in effect what I'm envisioning in this case. If you have a symmetrical high tech war, it will eventually produce enough attrition so that it will go back to a lower level. And that's also true with computerized weapons. If you have a computerized war, then the first step of the war is a cyber war. If both sides are quite good at the cyber attacks, the side which decides to go back to weapons which are not cyber would be the one that would prevail.
Yes, hi, I'm Pierre. I work on terrorism and counterterrorism. So thank you for your presentation, and I would like also to talk about nuclear weapons. As Michel said, you didn't put it into the picture, and so how would you integrate this issue, these weapons in the prospective works you're doing? Would it be the first system to be disabled, or the last one to be used before going back to low tech weapons? How would you envision it?
Yes. Well, can you say a little bit further about what weapons would be?
So would it be, you said before, for example, if the military decides to shut down all the networks, maybe there would be there would be an incentive to use their last one, which would be the nuclear weapons, or maybe not, or maybe they would be the first one to be disabled by the enemy, or how would you put it into the picture?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, this is kind of the thought experiment that I have in my novel recently published called Civil War II. I mean, so the thought experiment was what would happen when very high-tech army fought another high-tech army. Now, it's possible this could happen in the future with the U.S. against China, because they are working on being very, very high-tech, although they're not, I don't think they're quite there yet, but so that's a possibility in the real world. So I thought, well, if the U.S. fought their civil war again, the war that started in 1861, where it was exactly the same army that split into two, exactly the same weapons, exactly the same training, the two armies more or less fought each other to a standstill, but it became a war of attrition. In other words, the side that the North had much bigger economy than the South, so they were just able to throw more troops into it. The South actually had better generals and better tactics, until the North finally got a general who wasn't very interested in tactics, namely General Grant, who later became president, and he realized, well, they may be better than us, but we're more of us, and we will just throw as many troops in as possible. They call him Butcher Grant, because it's like our resource is having many more men and bigger industry. We'll just wear them down. Now, the scenario that I envision would be basically what in the U.S. we call the blue states and the red states. In other words, the liberal states and the conservative states decided to fight a war, and the military split into two factions with exactly the same weapons, including nuclear weapons. Now, my thought along this line is that There would actually be an agreement at the beginning of war, we're not going to use the nuclear weapons. Although at the end, when one side really starts losing, then you've got the problem like, okay, this is our last chance, so we can bring those nuclear weapons back out. But in a certain sense, it's like mutually agreed upon arms control have happened in quite a few wars, just because the consequences of using the extreme weapons are too devastating.
Hi, I come from Spain. I'm doing a research stay here in Paris for 10 days, and when I knew that Randall Collins was giving a seminar, I just rushed to come here because I'm a super big admirer of his work, and I feel very lucky to be here, so thank you for the organizers as well. And is this working? Hello? Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, so my... the phrase is not exactly a question, I think, and it's just, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think there was like a shutdown, not of the internet before, but it's just an historical episode. I think in Japan, they shut down the firearms from the 16th century to the 19th century, because there was some kind of challenge or threat to the sword lords, which I don't remember, the samurais and all this. So if this is happening, it could happen again, I guess. No, I mean, if Randall Collins is predicting something, I think that we all have to hear, because he have predicted many things. And the second, that will be like a question, This is a question about another kind of technology, and maybe not war, but politics. It's the idea of social media becoming an important force in politics, and social media all around. And especially I want to talk about this idea of the web brigades, which are basically troll farmers of 1,000 Russian, probably, because they are not probably, but they are, this is associated to Russia, 1,000 people. And the idea is that they are just not posting some kind of fake news, but they are also commenting in the comments and interacting with the guys which are commenting the fake news. And my point here is that I know that Professor Collins gives a lot of importance to interactions, not so to online interactions, but more to bodily co-presence interactions. But in this case, apparently, the point is that in web-based interactions with this kind of troll, web brigades of trolls commenting in comments, they can become an important political force as well, no? And it's just a question of, what do you think about this? Because I know that you really think about bodily co-presence as important for interactions, but maybe apparently with this Facebook craziness of social media mobs and all this, what do you think about this? It's kind of, and that's it. Thank you.
I suppose a question, because yes, what was very fascinating in your previous work was the idea of interaction between people that are face to face.
Yes.
What you describe today is people that are less and less face to face. So what do you do with interaction, with human interaction, in this world of dispersion of distance between actors?
All right. It's, well, okay. I'm going to have to improvise about this point. Are the social media an important political force? Well, so maybe there's an analogy here to what I was saying. If on the technological level, if both sides have very sophisticated high tech. See, so both sides, I say, have anti-missile missiles and missiles that can seek out radar and so forth. You put them on the battlefield, and after a while, they've destroyed each other. Does that mean the war is over? No, it means the side which goes back to weapons that can't be hacked or can't be put online is going to have an advantage. I mean, it's a certain sense in which guerrilla war has an advantage, although we're talking at a scale where you're really talking about big states fighting each other. Guerrillas really essentially can't take. They're essentially political. I mean, they're attempting to make a government collapse, but they can't really take it over unless the government loses its nerve and its support. Now, would that be the case with something operating through the internet? The internet is both highly connected and quite centralized. So in terms of system theory, some disruptive thing, a virus or something, could really propagate rapidly through the system. What's the response to that? Have a backup system which is outside the internet. I mean, I said this earlier about how in P.W. Singer's novel, the very first thing that happens is the U.S. satellites, which have the GPS coordinates, are hacked into by the Chinese, and so they don't operate anymore, and so you can't coordinate the forces through the satellites. The response to that would work is to have a backup system which is not connected to the internet. Or as I was saying earlier on, that military officers are saying, well, if everybody's using their mobile phones on the battlefield for their targeting, if we have a backup system which is not based on mobile phones, I mean, even if it's something like carrying messages by pigeons, or maybe not as crude as that, the side which can move backwards to a lower technology will have an advantage. Yeah, so there's a certain sense in which our belief that the technology is always moving forward isn't necessarily true in the military sphere. Now, so what about if it's a cyber war? Okay, a war of misinformation. We're trying to send deceptive messages. What have been the responses to that in the past? Well, I mean, so this was actually a big idea in the 1930s and 40s. The enemy is producing propaganda, so don't pay any attention, to it. In effect, it's like, go back to some more personal links of communication rather than the high tech ones. So I suspect that that's the sort of thing that would happen.
Thank you very much, Professor. It's an honor to hear you de visu. to continue your last answer, I think it's exactly the way the Department of Defense is thinking about the cyber war, because they are putting in place something that is called DODIN. It's a Department of Defense Information Network, which is like their own internet that you can only access with the tools of the army, and it's very secularized, and it's like a cloud, an iCloud from the DOD. I think a way to look at all the elements you gave us is to say that we are more focused on deterrence, like nuclear deterrence, very high technology deterrence, and we have success. We have no big wars with Russia, with United States and Europe, between European states. There is no war. We are in a very prosperous period. It's nice to say it. We are in a big peace period, but we can't fight guerrillas, like you said, and terrorist guerrilla too. So maybe I could say that we don't know to fight them. We don't have the strategic and mind resources to do that. So maybe I can do a reference to another book that you wrote, which is not at all about violence, about strategic or civil wars. It's Sociology of Philosophies. And you wrote this book, which I loved, of course. It's an honor to see you in real life. And you said that the periods where philosophical thought were very creative, it's when there are many schools that are fighting each other with pens, but there are many schools fighting each other, trying to do better than the others, like in China, in India, in Greece, or in European Renaissance and thereafter. So maybe the problem for United States and West in general is that there is no strategic contender yet. The only way you can imagine a big technology war is the United States to split. So the tragedy of the power is that there is no contender. They don't need to be at the very, at the point of the, at the top of the reflection. So we don't have this reflection. We have very remote adversaries. It's not changing our life until recently, and even it's not that a big change for all of us, what happened in Paris or 2 years ago. Even if it's important, it's not like changing our life. So is it a tragedy of the superpower not to be able to respond with a new thought about strategy?
One could say that the main advantage of the low-tech side, so you have a high-tech a state, and they're fighting against a lower-tech state. The main advantage of the latter is essentially political. If you hide in the civilian population, make guerrilla attacks, you don't actually have to win territory. You only have to not be defeated. And at any rate, in democracies, after a few years, people get tired of fighting wars and they become unpopular. I mean, if somebody is invading your territory, yes, the enemy creates an incentive for you to fight back at them. But if you're fighting on, you know, some remote site, then, you know, in effect, you lose your willingness to continue to fight in it. I mean, this is essentially what happened in the Vietnam War. I think it's, you know, probably the case from, you know, time to time, the various wars that happen in the Middle East, they sort of grind down and everybody loses their enthusiasm for them. They come back again, but in a sense, wars are, in the high-tech era, may very well be more political than they were before. You know, and a high-tech war is so much communication based, and, you know, so that it makes the war vivid to everyone. Probably at the time when, you know, the British or the French were creating their empires in the 18th and 19th century, the news came, you know, so seldom that there was no real, you know, domestic opinion about, you know, the costs of the war or the human atrocities of the war. I think, in effect, I think the reason why the U.S. lost the Vietnam War was because of modern news technologies. Mm. I mean, if that war had been fought, like, say, at the time of Genghis Khan, there would have been no public opinion against the war eventually. Enough force probably could have been used to bring it to a conclusion. I mean, so kind of in that sense, modern technology is above all communications technology, and that makes wars politically more difficult. Sure, at the beginning of the war, there's always a kind of a moral narrative, a scenario about, you know, why this is the moral thing for us to do. But over a period of time, which I think is quite likely, you know, less than 2 years, with the kind of news reporting that you can get, that people start finding the war to be morally disgusting, and then it becomes hard to sustain it. And it's for that reason that insurgents, guerrillas, don't have to win; they only have to not lose. They just continue until the other side gives up.